Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is November 28, 2013, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Drugs in My Pocket, Opioids in the Emergency Department. I'm recording this in the Hammer, yes, Steel Town, Hamilton, Ontario, home of McMaster University, and the home of evidence-based medicine. Now, these Hamiltonians are licking their wounds today after their losing Grey Cup performance. For all you American listeners, this is the Super Bowl of Canadian football. Yes, they lost to the Regina Rough Riders. So let's give this program here at MAC a little boost with a SGEM Journal Club. This will be the second Skeptical Guides Journal Club that we've done. The first one, if you remember, was done at the home of William Osler, who started Journal Club at McGill University in Montreal. That episode was number 50, Under Pressure, Vasopressin, Steroids, and Epinephrine in Cardiac Arrest. It was a huge success with Tafik and Tudor. What you talking about, Willis? Only the McGill students will get that joke. So today we have two new bright, shiny emergency medicine residents. Yes, we have Dr. Damon Atree, and I have to say that right? Atree, and Amy McCullough. Say hello to the Skeptic's Guide.
Hi, I'm Damon. I'm one of the PGY5s in the Royal College program with a special interest in anesthesia and pain management.
You see how calm and confident he sounds at PGY5. He's just so ready to go. And we've got Amy. Amy, say hello.
Hi, I'm Amy. I'm one of the EM residents in my third year here at McMaster. And I hope I sound as calm and confident as Damon over here.
If you don't find yourself sounding very confident, just throw on a cheesy Scottish accent like I do. Oh, my name's Amy McCullough. How's it going, eh? Wait a minute. That was a mix of Canadian and Scottish. We're going to be talking about pain management today, right?
Yep.
Pain in the emergency department. And this is a frequent problem, pain control in the emergency department. So we have a case scenario to set this up. We have a 33-year-old man who presents to the emergency department at 2 o'clock in the morning complaining of an infected tooth. And at the triage desk, he says, you know what? That oxy stuff worked really well last time. So the question, Amy, for today's podcast?
So the question for today is, can a departmental guideline on controlled substance prescriptions reduce opioid abuse?
Excellent. So, Damon, you had presented this at the Journal Club, and you'd come up with some background information. And in your introduction, you mentioned that you had a special interest in pain control. So let's bring everybody up to speed about the state of the union when it comes to pain control in the emergency department.
Sure. So in 2001, the Joint Commission of Hospitals in the U.S. made pain the quote-unquote fifth vital sign.
Damon, did you know that five is my favorite number?
I didn't.
I love it. The fifth vital sign.
So what that did was that it actually raised the awareness of oligoanalgesia in the ED. And in fact, in the U.S., the eMERGE physician started being evaluated and compensated based on patient satisfaction with pain control in the eMERGE. I think what that ended up doing was that it provided a kind of misguided incentive for giving out opioids in particular. The threat of this oligoanalgesia became so large that many practitioners started liberally prescribing opioids in spite of the risks which we all know about.
I think it's referred to as the Press-Ganey score in the U.S. That's one of the evaluations of, you know, patient satisfaction. And so giving out narcotics may be directly related to your patient satisfaction score. So maybe some of that sort of evaluation was driving the use of opioids in the emergency department.
We know that eMERGE physicians are among the most frequent prescribers of opioids. And certainly, you know, this whole intent of the Joint Commission and our intent as physicians is well-intentioned and it's noble, but you do have to wonder and ask yourself how many patients are actually being harmed by the addictive aspects of opioids, namely the euphoria and the side effects, like the respiratory depression. You know, this is all in trying to achieve a pain score of zero, which in many cases is probably unattainable. Throughout the years, many of us have been trained that all pain must be eliminated. We know that this is unrealistic in many cases of severe and refractory pain. And in fact, the only time that I try to completely eliminate pain is with ischemic chest pain.
I like that, Damon, a bit, though, about the, you know, the risk and benefit, right? Because we're always thinking in evidence-based medicine terms, number needed to treat and number needed to harm. And so there is that continuum or teeter-totter, you know, so how much pain medicine can you give to help someone? Because you want to help them. You want to, you got into medicine because you care about people and you want to ameliorate pain and suffering. But in the process, how many people are you going to harm in that process? And it's finding that Goldilocks zone of not too much, not too little, but just right. And that can be difficult.
The question I often ask myself, or I have asked myself over the past few years, is do patients want their pain to be eliminated at the expense of the side effects? So do they want to be more sleepy? Do they want to just not understand why they're in pain and just kind of get snowed? And we've all had patients in the ED who surprisingly refuse opioids, even in what would appear to be a very painful condition. The literature certainly supports this. It seems that more educated patients would rather live with some pain. There was a study by Platts Mills et al. That showed that after a car accident, educated patients actually receive less opioids compared to, more educated patients receive less opioids compared to less educated patients.
Amy, what are your thoughts on this whole pain issue before we get into the paper you picked?
Well, I think, one of the big failures that we might have in pain management is not explaining to patients the actual cause of their pain, and then, as Damon was saying, all the risks that are associated with opioid use. And I mean, when we're very busy and it is that 2 a.m. with a whole bunch of patients waiting, it can be easier to write a prescription for Percocet, 20 perks, than having that discussion. So I think that even though ED physicians may not have had a lot to do with causing this problem, we now have this public health crisis over the past decade with respect to prescription drug abuse, with the big culprit being oxycodone. There was a CMAJ study in 2009, the Dallas study, that raised some serious issues with the way that opioids are prescribed. And in Ontario alone, we've had a doubling of opioid-related deaths between 91 and 2004. A lot of this was related to release of long-acting oxycodone. And in fact, adding that to our Ontario drug formulary was associated with a 5-time increase in oxycodone-related mortality. A lot of these deaths were deemed unintentional, but the question is, could these deaths have been prevented?
So, Amy, those are some scary statistics. I mean, you double the death rate. And I mean, even if you're talking a small number, going from 1% to 2%, we're talking about really terrible outcomes, death. Right? So doubling that, you know, over that period from 1991 to 2004, and then oxycodone or OxyContin, the long acting version of that, comes on board, and you get a 5-fold, so 500% increase. I mean, that is a real epidemic.
Yeah.
Disturbing.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, we're all supposed to have an awareness of adverse reactions and all the patients we see who are having adverse reactions from all these medication effects we're putting them on. So I think that's huge. The situation has also been shown in the States. And in October of 2012, last year, ACEP published some practice guidelines regarding opioids. And so their suggestions was that we think carefully about individualizing opioid scripts. And
you mean they told us to choose wisely?
And they were suggesting in that choosing wisely that opioids were best left for patients with severe or refractory acute pain, and that we don't actually treat exacerbations of chronic pain with opioids.
So Damon, how do you approach patients when, you know, because we're going to see people in the eMERGE, you're in your fifth year, you're ready to go, you're at the top of your game. How do you approach people who come in with pain? What's your management? What's your strategy? Do you have some kind of protocol you could share with us?
So Ken, I think the most important thing, the first thing that I tell patients is that I can't take away their pain completely. I try to explain to them why they're in pain, when they can expect it to go away if it's known, and I really try to emphasize the kind of multimodal approach to the pharmaceutical aspects. Of course, I will also emphasize non-pharmaceutical aspects like elevating, you know, fractured limbs, ice, that kind of thing. So my approach from a medical perspective is acetaminophen and an NSAID, if they're able to tolerate NSAIDs, regularly around the clock. I will provide them a small amount of pure opioids as a last resort, but I will emphasize the side effects of the opioids. So I will tell them that they'll get constipated, they'll be sleepy, they may get confused, and they may even get addicted. And I tell them to minimize the opiates as much as possible. So Tylenol and Advil, for example, and you take your opiate if that's not cutting it.
So if you're going to pick an opiate, what's your go-to opioid?
My opioid of choice is hydromorphone. It's been shown to cause less delirium in the elderly, and there is a well-established synergy with acetaminophen. I try to completely avoid combination opioids. I find these to be dirty medications. Tylenol with oxycodone or Tylenol with codeine prevent me from giving the around-the-clock Tylenol.
And there's another problem, actually, with all these preparations containing acetaminophen, that you can get inadvertent acetaminophen toxicity and liver toxicity.
Absolutely.
You know, we're not talking about the narcotic side of things. We're talking about the liver toxicity just from taking too much of these combination products with acetaminophen.
Yeah. So I'm a simple guy. I like to keep it simple. Take the Tylenol out of the equation and kind of titrate each medication individually.
But the podcast today, we've got a case of a guy with a dental problem, and he's looking for dental pain relief. So do you have anything specific for dental pain patients?
Yeah, absolutely. When I see a patient with dental pain, my litmus test is whether they're going to accept a dental block. If their pain is so bad that they're willing to accept a small needle, granted, into their mucosa, I will give them an opiate as well. If I can't see anything and they refuse the block, despite my encouragement, then I go with non-opioid medications.
Damon, have you ever noticed that the people who, and this just might be recall bias, but people who are scared of needles are usually the ones that have, you know, multiple tattoos? don't you find that a little bit strange? Oh no, doctor, I don't like needles, and I'm staring at sleeve tattoos. Okay. Well, moving right along, Amy, you did the Journal Club, and you had a paper that you did recently for McMaster University's Journal Club, and I was wondering if you would introduce the paper that we're going to be discussing and critically reviewing.
Sure. Before I introduce it, I'll just get my vocals straight, because the first time I ever said the title of this paper, or this journal, I called it the Annals of Emergency Medicine. So the Annals of Emergency Medicine had a paper from Fox et al. From 2013, and the title was A Performance Improvement Prescribing Guideline Reduces Opioid Prescriptions for Emergency Department Dental Pain Patients.
And so what was the author's name again?
Fox.
So I guess we'll be finding out what the Fox says.
What Rob Ford says.
So for the PICO, we have a population of adult patients over the age of 16 presenting into rural emergency departments with dental pain. The intervention was controlled substances prescribing guidelines. So they created a guideline for prescribing controlled substances in these two EDs. The control was they looked at a one-year period before the new guidelines were implemented. And their primary outcome was opioid prescription rates for dental pain. And they also looked at the annual dental pain ED visits. Damien, what did they come up with for their main results?
So they found that their prescription rate actually decreased from 59% to 42%. So a 17% absolute decrease. Their dental pain visits actually decreased from 26 to 21 per 100,000 visits.
And I'm glad you gave that as an absolute decrease, because so many times we'll hear relative reductions and stuff, and it's nice to get the absolute number. So 59% to 42%, an absolute reduction of 17%. The author's conclusion to the paper were, quote, a performance improvement program involving a departmental prescribing guidelines was associated with a reduction in the rate of opioid prescriptions and visits for ED patients presenting with dental pain. End of quote. So some evidence-based medicine comments on this study is that it did look at a very, very serious issue that's difficult to deal with. Prescribing opioids in the emergency department is a challenge. However, the researchers did not cite any reference standards for performing this chart review. And the classic one, I always want to say the Gilbert and Sullivan, but it was Gilbert and Lowenstein in the Annals, Amy. Annals.
Right.
That's a different specialty. Annals is a different specialty. The Annals of Emergency Medicine, 1996. Gilbert came up with 8 quality checks to look at doing chart reviews in emergency medicine. And then, of course, that was built upon by Dr. Andrew Worster, published a paper in the Annals of Emergency Medicine in 2005. And they added 4 more quality indicators. And so there's this 12-item checklist that you can go through whenever performing a chart review. And if you're interested in doing research, I suggest you get the Gilbert and Lowenstein paper and the Worster paper and go through that while you're designing the paper, so we won't be so critical of it when we review it on the SGEM. So Amy, put on your critical hat. Good, you got it on. Let's go through those 12 things. First thing was abstract training. Were these people trained?
Yes, they had 1 hour of training.
1 hour. That may have been all it took to train to do this type of chart review, so reasonable. 2, case selection. How did they choose their cases?
They defined their inclusion criteria as being greater than 16 years old, and they excluded people who they thought had objective evidence of dental pain, so people who received an IND, IV antibiotics, or were transferred, and they also excluded cancer patients.
Okay, and so they were pretty clear on their inclusion and exclusion criteria.
Yeah.
Number 3, did they have a definition for the variable that they were looking at?
Yep, they defined their primary variable as whether or not a patient presenting with dental pain actually received a prescription for opioid medication at discharge.
And that should have been a fairly objective thing, because it would come to coding, you know, I've got dental pain. It's not sort of like ab pain NYD. It's I've got dental pain, and on the chart review, did they actually receive a prescription? How about number 4, data abstraction? How did they do that?
So they basically had a standardized spreadsheet, and they recorded their predefined variables on that spreadsheet.
So good. So they had a form that they could use.
Yeah.
How about number 5? Was their performance monitored, the abstractor's performance monitored?
In fact, no, it wasn't. It wasn't indicated if it was monitored, so we don't have an answer to that question.
So just because it wasn't on the chart doesn't mean it didn't happen. Just because they didn't mention it in the paper doesn't mean it didn't happen. But as a quality indicator, you should say whether or not you had some kind of monitoring of the people doing the abstracts. How about blinding?
No, the abstractors were not blinded to the objectives of the study. They knew what was going on.
I bet you're going to have more to say about that shortly. Number 7, inter-rater reliability. Was that mentioned? Did they talk about how well different raters did on abstracting the same chart?
They did, actually, and they gave some statistics for that as well.
Oh, so that covers number 8, inter-rater reliability tested. How about medical records identified? How did they do that? What was their medical record that they were working on?
So they described their medical database as basically they had their database for their own hospitals, but they also used a statewide database for prescription drugs.
And number 10, did they mention their sampling method?
It was basically a convenience sample, so all consecutive cases of computerized ED records with dental pain diagnostic codes.
How did they deal with missing data?
Well, that's a good question that I don't know the answer to, because they did not comment on that one either.
And that's one of the important things. I mean, you mentioned blinding already, but how we deal with missing data is really important, and how we solve those issues within, because often there will be, in a chart review, missing data. And number 12, ethics.
Very important, and yes, they did say that it was cleared by their ethics board.
And I know that we took a little time, Amy, to go through this a little bit slower than some of the other podcasts with regards to evidence-based medicine methodology, but you know, the methods are so important. And if somebody out there wants to do research and wants to do emergency medicine research and is thinking about doing a chart review, get these 12 items. Make sure you address these 12 items a priori before you start the study, and you will have a high-quality paper. You've got some editorial comments, though, beyond what we just went through in the checklist, Amy?
I do, yeah. I think I just want to pull out a few key points. So for me, one of the biggest issues I had with this paper was that the goals of the project, which was to reduce controlled substance prescriptions, the physicians involved were not blind to this. They knew that the study was going on. They knew that there was this guideline being created. And so this can create what we call an observer effect. And I'm just going to read a quote describing an observer effect. So whereby subjects improve or modify an aspect of their behavior, which is being experimentally measured, in response to the fact that they know they are being studied.
So this is going to affect their outcome, right? This is going to affect their results. I mean, we've seen it in our hospitals where, oh, we're having a hand-washing campaign, and somebody stands there with a clipboard outside a room to see if you wash your hands. What do you think with hand-washing rates? It goes up, right? So from a research perspective, how important was the guideline, or how important was it the fact that they knew we were monitoring whether or not they were writing prescriptions for controlled substances to patients with dental pain?
And I think it's, I mean, not only were they involved in the process of, you know, they were actually involved in the process of creating this guideline. So the ED chairman solicited input from the physician group and was a, quote, champion of the project. So they were involved from in actually creating the guideline, and then they knew that this study was going on. You know, there's this observer effect here, and as you mentioned, they didn't describe kind of missing data or some other things. So, for example, physicians who knew they were being monitored post-implementation could have, for example, not written dental pain as their final diagnosis if they had, say, given opioids but not wanted it to be included in the post-implementation monitoring. That's something that, you know, we can't account for because of this observer effect.
So some smart, tricky doctors may be gaming the system knowing they're being watched.
And then there was a few other things. I mean, it was kind of odd to me that they had this 14-month pre-implementation stage and then a 5-month post-implementation phase. So as with anything, there could be seasonal variation in people presenting with dental pain. There could be seasonal variation in, you know, department and whatnot. So I think that was kind of odd that they chose that. And then the other thing that sort of speaks to applicability is that this was done in some small rural EDs in Maine, and so this may not be applicable to large centers, to, for example, Hamilton in a large urban area. And so that just kind of speaks to the translatability of the study.
I really like that part of it, Amy, that it was in two small rural areas, because most of my research is in rural emergency departments. And so it was nice to actually see, a critical appraisal from your standpoint saying, this may not apply to the big city, because it's usually we're talking about some large urban academic centers, and I'm saying, I don't know if that would apply to my small rural center. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to see that situation reversed. It made me a bit more biased towards the paper, but I did like that.
Yeah.
Now you had something though, in addition, that a study in JAMA in 2011 about even if you reduce prescriptions, it doesn't really correlate to reduced mortality from opioids?
Well, I think, you know, when I was just trying to look at the bigger picture of this study, there was a study, Googleman and Perrone and JAMA, and basically describing that we don't actually have good evidence yet to show that reducing prescriptions from the ED actually means you're affecting abuse or mortality at all. And so I think if, you know, you're going to move forward and try to create guidelines or, you know, have some resources involved in doing this, that you actually have to have something to back you up to show that it's going to be useful in the downstream effect you're actually looking for. So even if you have a 17%, you know, say, decrease in prescription opioids given out, it doesn't mean it's actually impacting the effect that you're looking for. So
because their visit rates went down too for dental pain, so maybe those people just learned, oh well, don't go to those two hospitals for your dental pain,
exactly,
because they won't give you anything. So, you know, people may have learned, patients may have learned to avoid it, or it may have driven them onto the street to get their pain medicine from another source.
Yeah. So I think, you know, overall what I thought about this paper was that, in general they followed most of the methodology for a medical record review, but that the decrease that they found in prescribing may actually, you know, not be secondary to the guideline, but to several forms of bias, the observer bias we talked about, reviewer bias, etc. So that was kind of the biggest pieces I thought about the paper.
Well, from a bottom line, I thought that this paper left me with the following message. Opioid prescriptions in the emergency department will continue to be a problem, and this study does not provide enough evidence from a high-quality information standpoint for me to implement this particular guideline where I work. Damien, do you have a case resolution?
Yeah, so our 33-year-old guy with the dental pain accepted a block. We gave him some ibuprofen, a prescription for amoxicillin, and information on seeing a dentist the next day.
Excellent. So in doing some background research for this podcast, I found a nice little short video called a chalk talk, where they're on a chalkboard, and it was done by a very boring EM guy. Yes, it was Brent Toma, who runs the Boring EM blog, and he did a nice video providing some basic information to the approach to acute pain control. So I'll throw that up on the blog and you can check that out. Now, we had a Keener contest from last week, and the winner was Lauren Shepherd from Western University. And she knew the song. Oh, did you go to Western, Amy?
Western Meds, yeah.
Okay, well, she knew the song, Baby It's Cold Outside, was sung by Anne Murray and Michael Bublé. Amy, do you want to give this week's Keener contest?
I'd love to. So when we were going through our critical appraisal, we talked about the observer effect, which actually has another name. And so the Keener contest for this week is, what is the other name for this type of bias?
Yes, we were sneaky. We didn't mention that name. So if you know the answer, send it to thesgem@gmail.com. Put Keener contest in the subject line so I can find it. And if you're the first one to send me the correct answer, I will send you a cool skeptical prize. Now, we have some exciting news from the Beam conference world. We have added Prairie Beam in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada on May 12th and 13th, 2014. But if you can't wait to get all that Beam goodness, you can't wait that long, well, then you can always see the Beam Dream Team at Sweet Beam in Stockholm, Sweden. And they've now put up a registration link that's working. So if you want to go to Sweet Beam, just go to the website, click on the link, and you will get a registration form for March 17th to 18th, 2014. Damon, you're the PGY5. You're the guy ready to go. So I'm going to give it to you to give the Skeptic's Guide tagline.
Well, Ken, as always, remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Thank you very much, McMaster, for having me down and letting me do the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine Journal Club, number 2. Talk to you next week.